Welcome to Cultural Fugazi, an optimistic take on the culture of the end times. I am your host, Justice. I am joined by my co-host, Chris.
Hello.
Today, we are going to be doing a couple of things different from the other two episodes that we have done. We have put together a plan on how to run our podcast.
We've gotten organized, which is fascinating and scary.
It's the most powerful thing that we've ever done, is actually have a plan to accomplish a task.
So now we'll see how well that plan comes to fruition.
Yeah, let's totally screw this up now that we have one. So we are going to do a new episode the last Tuesday of every month. We are going to have those be specific topics. We don't know exactly what those topics are going to be until you know what those topics are going to be. So you won't have a good idea at the end of this episode, but we'll try to put some stuff out there so that you can beware. I don't know. We'll see. Who knows? And then we're going to do a topic for about an hour, keep it to 60 minutes if we can. And that's how we're going to do it. That's the new plan.
Yeah. So speaking of new topics, what are we talking about today?
So to start this new thing off, for January 2023, we are going to talk about masculinity, and specifically masculinity in a couple things that we've watched recently.
We're doing it. So, you know, even though we are doing a new format, we did say, we joked that it would never happen, and yet here we are. You plan, and suddenly, the world, it's your oyster. We are finally kicking things off with this new format with the masculinity episode.
Yeah. So for this week, what we did is we watched four movies. We're going to talk about specifically what movies. We're going to talk about how those movies interact with the topic that we're going to have today with masculinity, and kind of let you either watch those movies as well, come away with some thoughts and opinions on specifically what we think they say about a thing. And we'll do that every month, either with movies, books, music, and things outside of just one thing, and talk about how that does something that we think is either important, cool, or interesting.
Yeah, so before we actually get into the movies themselves, it might be a good idea for us to give folks some sense of what do we think masculinity is? How are we going to define it, at least for the purposes of today's discussion? So here's what we are working with today. Masculinity is a culturally specific set of norms, values, and ideas that get ascribed to men and how our culture thinks that men should exist in the world. Now, I think it's very important to point out, Justice, you brought this up when we were talking earlier, that this is very much about what culture thinks that man should be and not necessarily intrinsic qualities that we think that men have or that we even necessarily think that culture thinks that men has. This is really about what's culture's take?
Yeah, we talked about how we wanted to define this. We pulled up a couple other definitions. This was Chris doing his best wordsmithing on this specific topic. That's what we came up with. Remember, it's not exactly what we think masculinity is. I would say, Chris, between you and I, that we might not be the experts there. as men, I believe you have recently been described as, quote, soft, end quote.
That is a word that has come up maybe more than once very recently.
Uh-huh. And I think, as we can tell when I talk, that also not the most manly guy that you've ever met. I wouldn't say that we're out sawing logs with our teeth, you know, like.
No, definitely not. Not really sawing logs at all. So, you know.
I don't think I snore. So for this topic and our definition, what we did is we watched four movies. Those four movies were...
Indeed. So we watched The Green Knight, directed by David Lowery in 2021. We also, another very recent movie, The Northman. That one was directed by Robert Eggers in 2022. We watched, and this is a good one that we'll talk a little bit more about why it's interesting to discuss it now, but Creed, directed by Ryan Coogler in 2015. And then we're going to close things out, or the last movie that we discussed is Mad Max Fury Road. That's directed by George Miller, released in 2015.
The key component, the key takeaway I have there is that these are all bangers. Most of these are bangers. I liked most of these films. And we had a couple different movies for this list as well. We'll get into that at the end. Maybe some other things that we think are in conversation that aren't exactly these four movies, because this is a pretty big topic. And I think it's one of the things that you can pay attention to throughout every other movie that you would want to watch. You should be like, how do they portray men? Is that okay?
Yeah. You know, I might even argue that this is a conversation that we'll come back to at some point, perhaps with some new movies or perhaps with some different conversations around the movies that we're discussing today.
The thing that we've tried to do with this new episode structure is we're trying to come up with a thesis for these specific films. This one worked a little bit different. We sat down and said what movies would be cool to watch and also kind of talk about, or at least have a conversation about masculinity. So we watched the movies and worked backwards, which, hey, it happens. So I think we have a reasonable thesis that Chris also wordsmiths, if you want to take it away on what our thesis is on these four.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think, like you said, these are movies that I think whether or not one had a good time with these movies, they are visually stunning and very interesting. And a lot of that visual stunning language is in service of trying to make a point. So what point are these movies trying to make? Say that each of these movies is engaging with depictions of men and expectations of who they should be that sort of act as a lens through which we can think about our own culture's beliefs about masculinity. And each one has an idea of what masculinity is. And I think each one is trying to make a comment about the ways in which those ideas are positive or negative.
I would agree with that, Chris. That sounds like a good thesis.
Look at that. It's almost like we prepared.
It's almost like you prepared and I watched four movies while kind of drinking beers. But we're going to do this in order of the movies that we think makes most sense to go through. So we're going to do Green Knight, start with that and specifically what it says, and then work our way through Green Knight, The Northman, the two more indie style films, into Creed and then Mad Max. So if you hear us talking about stuff, we'll try to make sure that we're mentioning the movies as we discuss each specific one as well.
And it should be noted, there will most certainly be spoilers here. So if you do want to watch these movies and have not yet watched them, and spoilers are a thing that you are concerned about, to keep that in mind, because we're gonna talk about a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, you can also find anything that we reference specifically in the episode description and your podcatcher of choice. So, with that, I don't think there's anything else we need to do to kick things off. So let's go ahead and get into the chunk of the episode with discussing masculinity and The Green Knight.
Yeah, talk about a movie that has some things to say about masculinity.
Yeah, boy oh boy. So if you have not seen The Green Knight yet, Green Knight is a retelling of the story of, or the legend of the Green Knight with Sir Gawain, or as he is referred to in the film, as Garin. Garin? That Y is an R.
I'm not going to get too deep into this, but the way that language evolved and that it's a whole thing. Yep. We don't have to. That just has nothing to do with masculinity. So,
yep. Yes, but yes. So it's about the legend of Sir Gawain. He has to. He doesn't have to. But what he does is a knight shows up. Gawain cuts off the knight's head, and then the knight picks up his head and he goes, "In a year's time, I get to give you the same blow back." The film is a really interesting artistic exploration of what it means to have honor, what it means to act with that, expectations on greatness, and those specific details. We start with probably 20 minutes of film that we could discuss for 900 hours on specifically how we tackle what it means to have honor. The film, I think, does a great job of setting the tone on what it is for, what it is to be a man. Right away.
Absolutely.
You get a scene immediately, which is a man and a woman are walking away from a burning building, and you have no context. There's some farm animals around. The man puts the woman on a horse, and then they start walking away, and then the man pulls his sword out. And that's what the movie starts with. That's the expectation that it lays immediately on what it means for men and women in this specific telling of this specific tale and how they are different. You know, it is very, to have honor, to be a noble man is to, the woman gets the horse, you get the sword, and then onto whatever they do. You never see those characters again. I have no idea where they're off to, what they're going, why he needs a sword out in the first place. That situation seems pretty normal, even though there's a building on fire. Then we cut to Gawain.
And then even then, stake setting. Brilliantly done. You have a scene where Gawain is with his lover, Eslin. And, she is, they're having a very... They're having an intimate moment.
I think they're doing it.
They are definitely doing it. Yeah, and it's very clear that you have a Gawain who is, he's juvenile. He is definitely a bit of a, maybe not a playboy exactly. We don't get the sense that he's necessarily sleeping around a ton. But obviously, concern-wise, he was drunk the night before. You can tell that from how he wakes up. He wakes up having sex with his lover. And then when she tries to get him up and saying, oh, don't you have to go like become a knight? Isn't that a thing you need to do? I believe it's the first line that he even says is, or one of the first lines, I'm not ready yet.
Yes. Yeah. Is it about getting up? Is it about becoming a knight? It's kind of about, this movie, oh boy, subtlety is for cowards whenever we're talking about the entire thing. It's very much a house of ill repute. He throws money at her as a way to try to get out of his problems, right? As soon as he's trying to not do much. So it tells you a little bit about what his relationship is with the world. He spends his time in houses of ill repute, primarily with the same person, or so it seems, because she eventually asks, I want to be your lady in a way that's I cannot do justice to. But... The expectations, we move on from that. He loses his shoes because he's a patsy. He is literally, the minute we meet Gawain, the dude does not have his shit together at any point in time in the entire film.
One is a knight. Important things to keep your mind about. Your sword, your boots. That's like pretty high up on the list of things that a knight should be able to keep track of.
You would think, right? Like, hey, you're probably walking around doing important adventuring shit. He does thank his horse. He knows where his horse is.
Yeah, that's something.
So eventually we get introduced to our primary cast of characters. After we meet his lover, we go into meet his mother, the two primary women in his life. She is, in this specific telling, a version of Arthur's sister, who is Morgaine.
Morgana, yeah.
So his uncle is King Arthur in this specific telling, and she is expecting great things from him. It is also Christmas Day. So they're going to go to Mass. The whole thing is, I was out drinking my mass, my communion wine all night. So we go from that setting into our more traditional round table-esque. Again, if you have not seen the scene, all this stuff is done beautifully. And actually, this was all done with matte paintings for like some of the outside scenes or some of the inside scenes so that the rooms would look bigger.
It is stunning. It is visually stunning.
We get the round table and we get introduced to our other major male character in the film, who is King Arthur. And this iteration of King Arthur is frail. I wrote down the word vulnerable.
He is incredibly tender every time he deals with Gawain. Every scene, and you do get the sense that based on some things that he says later on in the movie, that perhaps that is not always the way that he has treated his nephew. But at least at this point, there is absolutely a vulnerability and a tenderness that is fascinating, because it is not necessarily, it's in direct juxtaposition with other expectations that you will see about how men should work. And yet you have the king who, and maybe partially because he's the king and he has the leeway and is at the top of the hierarchy. So he gets to be able to be tender without anybody questioning, but wait, where are your great deeds?
Right, yeah, which specifically Gawain gets to say, I have none, which, boy, if you've ever tried to be a grown-ass man and have had someone have expectations of you to say, what have you done? Nothing. No, I have not done shit yet. I'm in my 30s and I'm, you know, I have plans. Like, you know, I think I'm gonna start a podcast actually. So, you know, this idea, very much of a, I specifically said venerable and vulnerable are the two words. He's, everyone looks up to him. You could see how, Gawain looks up to him immediately. He is a larger than life character. He is King Arthur, but he can't lift his sword anymore, which also, if you need a metaphor, boy, but, throughout the film, whenever we see Arthur, he's very grounded, for a larger than life character. He is in a scene later in the film where he's talking to Gawain, getting Gawain ready to go on his quest. And he sits in a chair, and before they even start talking, you know, he's, didn't you hear me calling or whatever? He opens his mouth and starts fiddling with his tooth, and he just looks at Gawain and he goes, my tooth hurts. That's it. Like, that's the, because he's allowed to exist in this place where he's failing. Like, his body is failing him. He's no longer strong. The King Arthur of myth, he claims to have done big things. We don't get to see that iteration of Arthur. We see a man who is, you know, held together, but he still does the big King Arthur speech, right? So we're at Christmas. Everyone's around. Arthur wants to play a game where he says, regale me with your tales. Tell me a story. I want to hear of your deeds. Gawain says, I have none. Again. So then Arthur gets up and says, I would love to tell you of all of my great things. You've heard them all, whatever. I want to hear what you have done. And it's the way Arthur is blocked, the way that, like, the film portrays him as a character. He's got it. He's still got it. He's still the king.
Yeah, he's still very much the center of most of those shots. And even though he is small and frail, they shoot it in a way that he is often still towering over most of the other characters in the scene, which is interesting because he's towering over them, but he still also does look frail. He does look old. He does look vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We move on from that with the Green Knight shows up. We're fed some scenes where actually, Gawain's mother is delivering a letter to a fire. There's some witchcraft happening. And then this man who is a tree shows up, extends the letter to Guinevere, and Guinevere reads the letter that eventually says, strike a blow to the Green Knight. You know, it's all in his voice, and she does a cool thing where her voice changes and whatever. Strike a blow, and then I will strike a blow against you in a year's time on Christmas. You know, everyone loves to give and receive on Christmas.
It's a true Christmas spirit.
Yeah. I honestly forgot this was a Christmas movie until we were watching it. I was like, oh, I should have watched this on Christmas again.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I'm going to file that away for next year.
I'll put it right next to Muppet Christmas Carol.
It's perfect pairing.
Yep. So with this, Arthur, well, of course I would do this, but I can't. And Gawain says, oh, this is it. This is my moment. This is where I can show everyone the type of man that I am. Right? I have honor. This is not a thing that I'm scared of, while being absolutely petrified of the fact that he's going to do this.
Well, and I think an important thing to note here is that the sense that I get from this scene is not that Gawain is like, yeah, I'm going to take this guy down. I feel like I embody this mythological hero who can, this mountain, or this tree of a man. I can go toe-to-toe with him. Now, this is absolutely a case where he has just gotten done telling the king, who he clearly reveres, that he has no stories to tell. And he is acutely aware. The queen, right after that, says, oh, there's plenty of time for that. Don't worry. You will forge stories. You will make your myths. So immediately this knight comes in and he goes, I have to do this now. It is my responsibility. I don't think he wants to do it, but he feels obligated to because, well, I've got to make these myths. I told the king I would. The queen has faith in me. Here's my moment.
Yeah, the thing that I eventually wrote this. I have a ton of notes and they're scattered everywhere. I apologize. The thing that I wrote down was while Gawain is talking to the Green Knight. So he says, I'll do it. Arthur hands Gawain a sword and he's going to strike the Green Knight. And the Green Knight, you know, it kind of seems like it's going to be a fight, right? It's land a blow and I will return the blow in a year's time. And then instead of that, he has this massive giant green axe that's definitely magical. He sets that down on the ground and, you know, poses in such a way that says, strike me.
Yeah, he very much just leans his neck in and makes it very clear that, hey, you can strike a fatal blow if you want. I'm not going to push back. I'm not going to fight.
Yep. So Gawain then says, and the only reason we're doing it this play-by-play is because this stuff is very critical. Gawain then says, what do you want from me?
Yes.
That's whenever the Green Knight sticks out his head to be like, behead me. He does not say anything, but he very much sticks out his neck of like, this is where you should strike. And while he says, what do you want from me? Guinevere says, oh, what is it? Greatness or honor or something? She says something like that of that. That's the expectation. The expectation is not whatever this blow is.
Yes.
The expectation, what everyone wants from him is greatness. Again, subtlety is for cowards. We are just doing the whole thing. And he does.
But immediately before, in that same scene, the king then says, I want to remind you, this is just a game.
Yes. Yeah. The this is just a game is great because what is the expectation for this individual? What does it mean to have your myth, right? This is a game. This is a foolish, childish thing whenever we say the word game, right? At least that's the way I usually interpret as someone who likes games, childish things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's scared, he's fearful, he doesn't know what the expectations are, cuts this giant tree man's head off, and then goes, okay, like, look, I did the thing. And then the knight picks up his head, gets on his horse, and rides out. And it's great.
1 year hence.
Yeah. And then we do a cut to 1 year later. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. We do a couple of things where we see it snow, and we see Gawain wrestle with this new burden that he has.
He might do some more drinking. That might be implied.
Yeah, he very much deals with his expectations his way, which is to never rise up to them. That is the standard he has set for himself, and he continues to do that. With that, some of those are that's the first 20 minutes of the film. There are a billion other things that we have left off, and that was a really detailed explanation, but there's even more. We get to a couple scenes where we start really seeing what the film thinks of other men. So right now we have two men. We have Gawain and we have Arthur. We also have the Green Knight, but he's from outside. He is an outside force. They don't even refer to him as a man. I believe he's referred to as something else from other places.
Yeah, we do get some hints of that later on.
Yeah. The Knights of the Round, we don't get named knights, but everyone's there. No one really does much, but after Gawain cuts off the head, everyone starts drinking and
cheering and very clearly indicating to Gawain, you have made the correct decision.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, yes, you did the thing you were supposed to do.
Right. And not only that, but, you know, they're enjoying it as a show. We get a puppet show of the same thing. The story of Gawain is picking up steam. He's now burdened by everyone knowing exactly what he's supposed to do 1 year from then. So he can't just kind of walk away from it. It's not like a thing that, oh, you know, his family might dislike him. Everyone knows who he is, and they've all heard a different version of what happened. And he goes to a bar, and we see what the other expectations are for men in this world, right? If you can't deal with it, you go get drunk, and you get in bar fights. So pretty standard stuff. Understood expectations.
Yeah. Well, arguably, you know, you have a situation where the Gawain is interacting with masculinity in a way that I think, again, we talked about how are these movies in conversation with our own cultural ideas about masculinity. This is a game. It is a game of honor. You have to perform. You have to play the game. If you play the game right, you will get accolades. But that doesn't mean that you aren't going to end up drinking away your days feeling like, I am a fraud. I did not live up to, I don't even know what I want here, but I'm being told this is the right thing. I am going to continue to do the quote unquote honorable thing because this is the game that I feel I am supposed to play.
So he, you can see the mental calculus. Maybe he's thinking of not doing this. Maybe he is going to do it. We don't know what he would have done in a vacuum. Arthur shows up. That's what the tooth hurting scene. Arthur shows up and says, all right, it's time to go on your quest. It's a 4-day ride. You got time. Get on your horse. Get on your way. His mother has been working for casting spells on a green sash for him to, or a green belt for him to wear, that has magic sewn into it. That is, she says, if you wear this while you receive the blow, you'll come home to me. Right. So there is a spell on this belt. We know that she is a successful witch because she got the knight there in the first place. Gawain does not know this. But she says, if you wear this belt, you'll come home to me. This will be important later because Gawain's an idiot. and then, you know, he sets out on his quest. We see some of the expectations of what everyone else has for him whenever he leaves. But we don't really start interacting with different portrayals of expectations until we get to the battlefield. That's, I think, that the next major benchmark here is we get to the battlefield scene. Gawain on his horse, he has all of his stuff. He kind of just left. He's very, very new to this for trying to be a knight, or at least to try to go on a quest. Stumbles into a boy on a battlefield. And the boy, does the boy set some expectations on what it is to be a man? Every single word out of his mouth is what it means to have honor, or even to just be manly in this specific universe. We get lines from him, a line from him that specifically says, in this battle, the king slayed 970 men, or 960 himself, but I could have taken him. I could have gotten him. You know, this boy claims his brothers were in this fight, and no one walked away alive. Everyone in this fight is dead. And even though everyone is dead, which I think we know as people is not our ideal day.
Yeah, I would tend to agree.
I wouldn't line up for that, right? He says, of this tragedy, no one walked away alive. He sets the expectation that he would have lasted longer.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Not subtle. We're not subtle here. But with that, it's very much sets the expectation of what a common folk would think being manly is. This king slayed 960 people by himself. I could take him down. Now, surveys have gone out to men across the globe that say if a woman plays a sport, like even though they are the best at it in the world on the women's side, men seem to think that they could still take them. You know, people still think they could beat Serena Williams at tennis. It's
fascinating.
I can't hit a tennis ball. Yeah, right. You know, like I would never in a million years have the expectation that, like, you know what? I could probably take him. You know, she's really good at tennis. I don't know how to, I don't even know how to serve.
Right.
What I know about tennis, I learned from Mario Tennis. That's it. That's all I got. So, you know, we see that reflected back in the boy in the field, to really drive home a standard of masculinity.
Yeah, it's very clear. And I mean, that is what this character is. This character is Bluster. That is who he is. And he is doing that because he believes that that is what he has to do in this world to survive. And like, based on what we see from him, it's not clear that he's entirely wrong on that front. But also, he is completely full of it the entire time. And you very quickly realize nothing that he is saying is even remotely true. Not even close.
Not even a little bit.
Yeah. But the way he says it and the way he carries himself, it'd be real easy to believe it's true. And there's clearly playing into an expectation, like greatness, honor. What is required of a man in this world? If you cannot do those things, then just say you did them.
Lie. Yeah. Lie, cheat, steal. Why not? What's there to lose?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're going to end up like another one of these bodies on the battlefield, so who cares?
Yes.
The movie does a lot. There's a lot of other things that are happening. Our other primary male character, so that we can not talk about this for the entire length of the movie, is the lord that we run into in the woods. There's a couple other scenes. I think there's great stuff to talk about with St. Winifred.
Yes. But
just good stuff, but not really about, more about honor and less of what it is to have a man in the world. Gawain eventually goes to a hunt lodge, and we meet the lord. If you know the legend, this lord of this manor allows Gawain to rest before he moves on to the final part of his quest, and he says, you know what? I'm on a hunt. I will go out, and I will hunt and kill things, and I will bring you the best that I find, as long as you give me what you find in my manor, which could be all kinds of things. And he goes, what is it? This is your manor. I don't understand what you mean. This is your house. What would I find in here that you don't already have? And he explains, you know, manners are strange things. Who knows? You'll know. You'll know when you see it. He lives there, or he's on his hunt with his wife. There's also a blindfolded woman who's there who no one else can see because magic. Gawain eventually is in this house with these two people, and the huntsman is found. As soon as Gawain walks into the house, he's wearing a bear skin. You know, he is your big, burly man's man. This is his hunting lodge. He is there with his attractive wife. You know, this is a guy who just radiates dude.
Yeah, absolutely.
We go from that, to his wife, who is played by the same actress who plays Gawain's lover.
Yeah, from Essel. Yeah.
Yeah, from before. And she has some ideas on what it is to be a man that she specifically lets Gawain know, which is, why is this knight green? It's because green is the color of life, but also the color of rot, and it's what you bring. Gawain has tested him multiple times throughout the entire film.
He has tested a number of times, and I think very often he fumbles through and ends up making a good choice by not making a choice. And I think we see here a moment where he goes, I want this one. This one, yes. I will say yes to this. Yeah. And not his finest moment.
Yeah. He specifically is challenged with not fucking someone else's wife. That is his challenge. That wife really wants to, leads him on and yada, yada, yada. She is interested in Gawain for multiple reasons. Her husband's out all day, whatever. She is the bored at home housewife. He has one challenge. Be a good guest. That's all the huntsman asked of him, right? Give me whatever you have in this house. He's lost everything to this point and usually has regained most of it. So he has the axe from the Green Knight. He's lost it. He's gotten that back. He does not have his mother's magical sash anymore.
Yes, our blowhard liar.
Yep.
Stole that from him.
He took everything. It turns out the arrogance of man is always truly the worst thing that can happen. And she has, the wife has this item left. So Garwin, our knight, gets it in a scene that is really good with what do you want? Do you want it? And it goes places in a way that's very enjoyable. it's very much, again, like subtlety, why this, what's happening here.
And again, like the one time that he's making a specific, he is saying yes to a situation, not just stumbling in whatever direction gravity is pulling him.
Yeah. He specifically in that moment decides to be a coward. right? That is the choice that he makes at the time. Give me the magical sash. Everyone else has been leading me on. I'm telling you, that's what I want. I don't want to die. Which is reasonable. The expectations for him are not really, hey, you know, die, but it's to face the thing with bravery, right? That is the expectation we have for him. To meet the challenges that you rise, to rise to the challenges that you meet along your quest. And the boy can't.
Yeah, and I think this is the moment that crystallizes, you know, like I've mentioned a couple times, he's fumbled through all of the other decisions and has basically managed not to admit that he is a coward. And this is a turning point where this is the moment where you have to decide, you have to make an active choice whether or not you will be a coward or not. And that directly plays into the idea of what is a man supposed to do, like you were saying about honor. You're supposed to go on this mythical quest. You're supposed to be brave. You are supposed to be a knight with virtue. That is what a man does. And beginning of the movie, Gawain told us, I'm not ready yet. And here he is forced to admit that that is true. He is forced to say, yeah, I'm a coward. Yes, yes, give it to me. I want the protection.
Yeah, he gets a lot more than protection. Yeah. And then, you know what? That is also his most shameful realization, right? He comes away from that with that shame intact. This is not another situation where he walks away from, like he did with St. Winifred, where he asked her, well, what can you give me for doing the right thing? And she specifically says, why would you ask me that? Why would you ever ask me that?
One of my favorite lines in the entire movie.
Yep. And the Lord stops him on his way out. You know, he's been giving Gawain all the things that he found on the hunt, the best of the best, the cream of the crop, if you will. And he says, well, you're supposed to give me everything you found in my house. And he leans down and he gives him a big old kiss. And it's interesting. There's a couple things here that we didn't talk about earlier with physical touch. Arthur very much physically touches Gawain, gives him reassuring shoulder, you know, grabs his shoulder reassuringly.
This is the tenderness. This is very much how that comes through.
Yes.
It touches his cheek a few times.
Yep. So with that, we are, you know, men don't touch, men don't show emotion. That's not the manly thing to do. And this man killed a bear, wears a bear's skin for fun when he's just walking around his house, leans down and gives a very tender, very great, I looked like a good kiss.
Yeah, I would agree. I would tend to agree. Yes.
Gawain,
he leaned in before he didn't.
Yeah, he definitely, he's like, ooh, this is nice. And then he says, unhand me, right? Getting kissed by anyone who you weren't expecting is probably surprising. But very, very tender moment. Because he knows, the man knows his wife. So, you know, he knew that was a thing that Gawain had that he did not, was, you know, the affection of the woman who lives in his manor. With that, Gawain doesn't give him the belt, the magic belt that he got there. So he's a liar. He's a cheat. And he goes on and he goes to face the Green Knight. We do a montage of what it would be like if Gawain is who he is when he leaves the manor.
Yeah, and a very key point to that montage is that it revolves around him keeping the sash in place. It involves around him, you know, looking to that as a source of protection, and the way that we discussed how that is a mechanism that points towards his cowardice, really leaning into, what if I make the cowardly choice? And a lot of him making the cowardly choice is failing to recognize who he actually is as a person and to reckon with that. And that's what the manor is all about. Gawain, we are going to force you to confront yourself, and we're going to force you to make a decision about who you are. Now, that doesn't have to be a permanent decision, but we need you to understand where you stand currently. And I believe when he first gets to the manor, the huntsman even says, oh, well, we'll help you with your trial with the Green Knight. You know, he specifically says that they'll help. And initially you get the sense that means that, oh, he's willing to like actually go there with Gawain. But the further along you get, the clearer it is that, no, there's an aspect of this where Gawain needs to reckon with his own failures before he can truly be presented to the Green Knight and succeed, whatever that means.
So the end of the film, we do get to the Green Knight. Gawain has his revelation of what life would be if he is the man that he is today, and doesn't have that that epiphany of what it means to actually be the type of man who the film has been leading him to become the entire way, which is the characters that we've walked away with honor are emotional. They are tender, right? They are not, Arthur is not stoic. Arthur does not suffer in silence. You know, he has a pain and he goes, my tooth hurts, right? He's, you know, they're not the most egregious, stoic, manly men that you would get in like a Clint Eastwood movie, right?
They are complicated and they are allowed to have emotions and be vulnerable.
Yep. And, you know, Gawain gets to do that, where he shies away from the blow multiple times until he finally takes off the sash.
Well, and I think it's important to note that in that the point where he has the vision of what his life would be like if he ran away, if he kept the sash on, if he continued to, I mean, you can really think about the sash as, I am going to be that stoic. It is him embracing the idea of masculinity that is the, I can't be hurt. Being hurt is dangerous. That vulnerability, whether it be emotional or physical, like they make it very explicit. They're like, no, this is you being vulnerable. You have to decide whether or not you're willing to do that. And, you know, you brought up the other two, like, non-braggadocious liar characters that we get as representations of masculinity. One of the things that the film is very clearly trying to do here is go, at the beginning of this movie, you were told that this character needs to pursue honor and bravery. And you probably thought you knew what that meant. You assumed that that meant behead this giant tree, go out on a quest, be stoic, fight, come back with tales of your accomplishments and the people that you've bested and the stories of all of the glorious things that you've done. But at this point in the movie, after we see what it could have been like, it is very clear he gets to live that life where he is that kind of, he has that kind of honor. And that life is hollow. That life does not provide him with any emotional satisfaction, and it leaves him cold.
Yeah, they really drive home what this particular character failure means for Gawain. To have this unlearned lesson on becoming who they think the type of man they think he should be, right? Who the people around him expected him to be, which is a man with honor, a man with integrity. It sounds like go fight, win, when actually it's go be great. And what does that greatness mean? That greatness does not mean a king who slays 960 men on a battlefield. It means a man who can face the unknowable or, you know, the challenges that you've set up for yourself, right?
Who can be vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like, literally, can you be vulnerable?
Yep. And at the end of the film, he does. And we don't know how that works for him.
But we do get, I love the way that this wraps up so beautifully. He, after flinching multiple times and after getting the scene of him running away or imagining running away and seeing what that would be like, what his life would be like, we get him finally taking the sash off, resting his head in a place where the Green Knight can land the blow and going, I'm ready.
Yep. Yeah. No, yeah, totally. It's full circle.
Yes.
And the one takeaway that I really had from that, and the scene that's him coming back hollow, right? He is a lesser man because of what he's done. And I mean lesser in like the actual sense of he's less of a person.
Yes.
There is the moment where you see his death in that specific life. And it doesn't matter. Nothing none of it matters, right? The life that he leads without this bit of honor is meaningless. That's what I took away from that, right?
Yeah.
Is there's nothing there. There's nothing for him other than shame. And the small step of having honor when it matters most, again, we don't know. According to our director, there was a different scene at the end of this movie, and he took it out, which you do know what happens to Gawain. That head rolls, and that's it. That's the end of the story. But he took it out because he wanted it to be a little bit more open for interpretation at the end of that.
Well, and I do love the way that the film ends that he does leave in is the Green Knight, and we don't see anything after this. He traces his thumb across Gawain's throat and says to him, "Well, off with your head then."
Right.
Which, does that mean that he cuts his head off? I don't know. Does that mean off, comma, with your head? Leave?
Right.
With your head still attached?
Yeah. We don't know.
Yeah.
There is a post-credit scene. I don't know if you knew this.
Oh, yeah.
There's a post-credit scene. It's in his vision of the future. His daughter is playing with the crown.
Yes.
From that specific thing. We don't know. I have no idea if that's relevant. The canon, what is canon in this film is interesting.
It does play around a lot with, I mean, it never makes it explicitly clear, or it does a lot to make it so that you could take some of the visions that happen and go, oh, no, that's the thing that actually happened. There are some other moments in the movie where a thing happens that seems like a vision, but you could absolutely read this as, oh, no, Gawain died here, and the rest of this is just a dream. So I think that it's very much playing with that idea of what is real, what is the story, what is the myth. That is also part of it.
Yeah. For all we know, he died in that other world, and this is all flashback to the moment where he realized his life had gone wrong. Does he get is this a chance for him to roll it back and do it right? But I think from our perspective on this movie really sets a tone on what it is to be a man. Holy shit. The expectations are very clear on what it is to be a man, to have honor, to be tender, to have vulnerability. All of the characters that I think you would walk away with as great, specifically great men, are not stereotypical big bro guys. Even the one who is multidimensional. And I think it's Arthur is very healthy. I think Arthur is a really compelling and healthy way to portray some of these types of conversations.
Yeah, I think the movie does, again, a really beautiful job in that first 20 minutes of setting up a lot of the stakes, as well as really telling you what conversation it wants to have, because I think it absolutely does present you with both sides of the sort of like idea of masculinity. You get, there's a lot of the conception of masculinity as the honor, the glory, the battle scars, the stoicism. But then you are immediately presented with Arthur as the patriarch who is tender, the patriarch who is kind, the patriarch who is vulnerable, who has those stories, but that is not the only thing that defines him. So I think the movie, right from the get-go, and the rest of the film just like really hammers this point home over and over and over again, is saying to you, hey, being honorable and being a good man is not about winning battles and not being vulnerable. It is not about protecting yourself and winning the day. It is about the ability that you have to be vulnerable, the bravery that it requires to do that, and the things that allows you to do and the people that allows you to connect to. And the people who are able to do that are presented as the compelling male figures. They're allowed to be multidimensional, and that multidimensionality makes them more interesting and makes it clear that they are having a better time in that world than a lot of other people are.
Yeah. It's one of the things that I think, one of the things I took away from it, because we're going to transition from that into the Northmen really fast, is some of the casting decisions. Not everyone is white in the movie. With a movie about a medieval society, that is one of the things that I think the casting for that thing is great. It's still primarily white, but we have
I mean, Dev Patel is our lead.
Yeah.
Putting the focus on a non-white main character. And I think one of the things that is particularly interesting about that is the ways in which, like, the lens of masculinity in our culture gets refracted through race, mm-hmm. and the ways in which, like, even with the Arthur example, the higher up you are on the hierarchy, the more latitude you hypothetically have to be able to display something that is not the stereotypical cultural norm of masculinity as stoic and hard and unyielding. But I also think that very often the way that you get to the top of that hierarchy is by not doing that. I think that very often people that are lower down who are of other races don't have as much. They have to be hard because the only way that you get to participate at all is if you play as closely to the rules as you can. And that's what our main character does initially. But the movie does a nice job of making it clear that no, that is not the way. Right. And yes, you have the king who is white, who, like, doesn't have to conform to those stereotypes, but the king is also encouraging Gawain to do the same. And, like, I do think that that seems like it was an intentional choice to me. I do not think that anything in this movie was done by accident.
No, St. Winifred, also played by a biracial actress. I think there's a lot of things where the movie touches on what it means to tell a story like this while understanding the audience of who's ingesting that story. Because I wanted to bring that up, because as we move on to the Northmen, where we are telling a Viking story and very much not about any of that. So that was kind of the last point that I wanted to
yeah, good to get that in there.
Yeah, just like, hey, there's actually a...
This is going to get real white for a while.
Yeah, we're going to be real white, and then we're going to talk about Creed, which is very much a very different expectation on some of those things that are culture. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we're back to Cultural Fugazi.
All right, so next up, we're going to talk about The Northmen.
And for probably half as long.
probably
half as long. I think the critical component with The Northmen on how it approaches masculinity is a couple things. One, does it do anything new that... As you said earlier, this is Hamlet. So,
yes.
Hi, Hamlet. Never seen a red Hamlet.
Oh,
yeah. I just haven't. I get it.
It is. There are a couple of points of departure, like the Olga, who is your Ophelia analog, that ends much better for Olga in the movie than it does for Ophelia in Hamlet. So, you know, things like that. So there are some differences, but I mean, ultimately, and it is important to say, actually, this is very important to say, Hamlet is a sad, sad, sad sack. He is more like the conception of what you would think of masculinity when you think of us.
Yeah, boys.
I'm going to think about how sad I am for a while, and then I'm going to talk about it, and everyone's going to get real annoyed hearing how sad I am all the time. Hamlet is...
a little less emo, a little bit more death metal.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a very accurate description.
The Northmen is a movie directed by Robert Eggers. And if you've never seen a Robert Eggers movie before, this is a guy who has something to say about guys being dudes. Known for directing The Lighthouse, as well as The Witch, which I've never seen The Witch.
I also have never seen The Witch.
So, but if it's anything like what he's done with The Northmen and The Lighthouse... There's some thoughts of men involved. We're doing a little bit less of The Lighthouse, which we won't get into because you could just do an essay on the man's work and his thoughts on men, which is anyway. So a whole separate thing. With The Northmen, we get Skarsgård, Alexander Skarsgård, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
I say right because I always get worried that I never say his first name. He's just Skarsgård to me, or he is the other vampire.
Sure.
He plays a angry Viking man who eventually meets Russian witch Anna Taylor-Joy, is mom is played by Nicole Kidman, which we talked a little bit about. Meta commentary in the film is Skarsgård and Nicole Kidman were husband and wife in a TV show together between like 2017 and 2019. So then they are playing mother and son, which is interesting.
Well, and particularly with how that relationship ends up.
Yep. Yep. We go place again, Hamlet. There are some things here. There are some questions about moms. There's some mom issues.
Yeah. This has thoughts about moms. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is an episode about masculinity, yeah. So we're going to be talking about dads.
It also has a lot of thoughts about dads, so.
Yeah. Our sad Viking boy, which is not initially played by Skarsgård. I don't know who plays him when he's younger. Very much has to deal with life as a prince. He's a Viking prince. His dad is a successful warrior. And his dad has thoughts on what it means to be a man. We are introduced early on to what the expectation is for a young boy, which is to not come into your mom's room uninvited, which now that we know what his mom's up to by the time we get to the end of the film, sure, makes sense to me. Which also, universal truth, don't go into your parents' room.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going on.
Give them space.
Yeah. That's their
people
room.
Too.
Yeah. And then his dad comes home from some sort of conquering conquest with a wound. He sits in a room who is played by Ethan Hawke, which, man, Ethan Hawke looks good with a beard.
He does look good with a beard.
He just looks good. Anyway, he sits down with this wound. He's welcomed home in a grandiose fashion by his court jester, played by William Dafoe, which is great. He's really good in that specific role. He pulls out his finger like it's a penis and slaps it away. It's funny. It's good.
He has a good time with it.
Yeah. And he's welcomed home as a conquering hero. And then when we talked about King Arthur being vulnerable in The Green Knight, we kind of see the opposite of that from a king. We see toxic masculinity and its finest. This is a stoic man. Well, I wouldn't even call it toxic yet, but it's a man who suffers.
We get there.
We get there. He's a man who suffers in silence. No one knows. He hides his wound even from his wife until she needs to see it.
And that interaction, when she finally does see it, she is asking him to join her in bed. She's like, come, let me care for you. Let me take care of you. And his response is, no, I must be hard. I must show my son what it is to be a man and get him prepared to be king, because someday I will die. So this will have to wait.
Not only someday I will die. I will die in battle.
Yes.
I will not die sick and frail from this wound, and I will not die a disgraced graybeard. You know,
yes.
I don't want to live too long or too weakly. I'm going to die glorious in battle to get to Valhalla.
There is no time to be tender with my wife, which, hey, that ends up being a problem later for a bunch of reasons.
Millions of reasons.
Yes. No, I got to go bark like a dog in this weird hut.
Yeah, so they do mushrooms. He does mushrooms with his son and William Dafoe.
Yes.
And they howl at the moon and set expectations for what it is to be the son of a great father, which is, if I die, you must... I don't know. I don't have the exact...
Should I fall by the enemy's sword, you must avenge me forever or live in shame.
You know, normal things dads say.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, and this, I mean, this hut scene very much does, this is not our introduction, but this is a very clear explication on Eggers's, hey, hear how men do. Because he constantly through this movie points towards men having an animalistic nature. And that part of being a man is you are a dog, you are a bear, you are a wolf. That is what's inside of you. And as a man, you have to learn how to control that. And that is still always part of your core. But you need to show me, are you more wolf or are you more man? And that is the very start of this scene is, are you a dog? Are you a wolf or are you a man? That is the very first thing that they do as the mushrooms start to kick in.
And do you know how they figure out that they're men?
Yeah.
Is by burping and farting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is great. The couple other things that happened in that scene, worthwhile to come back to. We talk about weakness and vulnerability, right? And what it means to be tender and have tender moments, because that is not usually used as a way to portray manliness.
Oh, this is very important, yes.
Our young boy version of our hero sheds his last tear in weakness.
Yes.
Whenever he sees that his father has a deep wound that will probably kill him, either in the immediate short term or, you know, longer term through extended illness.
Yeah, part of Eggers' storytelling style is to make some of these kinds of emotional beats like very, very like tangible and explicit. So the tear, it is like a crystal. The Willem Dafoe grabs a crystal from Amleth's face and says, "This is it. This is your last tear. You don't get to be soft anymore. You're done with that now.
Yep.
Vengeance forever. That's it."
Yeah. Again, expectations they're pretty high,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Hey, if your father dies by the blade, your entire life will be about avenging him, or you will live in shame forever. This is the last tear you will shed in weakness about your father. Doesn't matter. Anything that is now is hard rage stoicism.
So, Justice, that having been said, what's the next thing that happens in the story?
Oh, so they walk outside and his dad dies.
He doesn't just die,
he gets murdered by the blade.
Huh.
Right away. Hey, huh? We set some lofty expectations about what happens whenever your dad dies. Live, you know, live avenging his spirit for forever or live in shame. Bad news. It's time's now.
Yeah. Vengeance has knocked.
So he's killed by his brother. The king is killed by his brother. They move on, and our hero rows away going, "I will avenge you, father. I will save you, mother. I will kill you," the name of his uncle, which is whatever. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's gone. It's blanking. So we cut to years later. And hey, I don't think he grew up healthy.
Hey, what gives you that idea?
I think he might be emotionally compromised.
Huh.
This is when we get to toxic masculinity. So eventually it's a bunch of men rowing a boat up the river. They see two guys fishing, and someone on the boat grabs a bow and arrow and shoots those two guys who are fishing, minding their own business, whatever, because they're about to wreck a town, enslave the people who are worthy, and kill the rest.
Wreck is a very nice way to put what they do to that town.
They are raping and pillaging is the technical terms. So they show up. They are your mean Viking berserkers. They do some animal rituals, and they are in the land of the Rus. So, which is Russia, I'm assuming.
Yes, absolutely.
This is me being ignorant of anything before recent times, let alone 1897. Or 897, excuse me, not 1897. Yeah. So they go, they kill an entire town, rape and pillage, enslave the rest, and then he does not yet have his awakening, or he has his awakening once he's through this. So he's been living eyes closed, not really processing anything that's happened to him. Men would rather become berserkers than go to therapy. It's just a fact.
Yeah, you know, why go to therapy when you can rip a man's throat out with your teeth?
Right. You know, but we've set expectations.
Sure.
So we go to this town. It's very detailed and specific.
Yeah, so in the town, after this bloody battle has happened, and Amleth and the men that he's with, who act like animals, this is very explicitly made clear because they're wearing wolf's pelts and they are murdering people just brutally. You see a scene where I believe both a woman and a child are brought into a house, and that house is set on fire. This is very important because when you burn a bunch of women and children, if that town happens to have, say, a witch, then that witch might show up in that building later on and might have a conversation with our main character where this is where the eyes are opened again, where Amleth is reminded. You know, she says, you cannot be the boy who does not cry anymore. She gives him back the tear and says, now you have to go meet your fate.
Yeah, he's given a reminder of what he thought he lost, right? This is your last tear shed in weakness. It's back now. It turns out you have undealt with trauma. So how does a person who's never had to deal with undealt trauma deal with trauma, especially our stoic man, our war veteran, murder machine, shirtless bear killing monster?
Hey, is it going to involve some murdering?
Yeah, he's definitely not going to go see a psychiatrist.
Ugh.
The man's not going to go to therapy. He figures out where his uncle is. His uncle is
he's had to flee to, I think it's somewhere in Iceland.
Yeah, it's Greenland or Iceland or, yeah. Or whatever one's worse. And because he lost his kingdom. He killed his brother for naught. He's now a sheep farmer.
Yes.
They go to the farm.
Yes, Amleth becomes a slave specifically so he can sneak onto this farm.
And on the boat, he meets a background character through our primary village battle, Olga, played by Anna Taylor-Joy.
Which is all the way down.
Yep. So she is casting a spell at some point in time on the boat. He figures out that she's a witch or... There's even a scene early on.
She calls him out. She's like, "Hey, you're a Northman. What are you doing here? What's your story?
You need to be more.
You're not a slave.
Yeah, you need to be a more cunning wolf to pass in your sheep's clothing or something." Is what he's informed as. But there's even a scene early on about witchcraft, which is specifically why did Odin lose his eye? Is brought up earlier, and it's so he could learn the magic of women, because only women are witches. So our man doesn't have any ability to do magic, but he is aware of it. He has both eyes, so I don't know. But
yeah, it's specifically the secrets of women.
Yeah, the secrets of women.
Never seek the secrets of women, like Odin did, but always heed them. It is women that know the mysteries of men, the Norns that weave the fates of men.
Yeah, so, you know, these are very much separate people. They have, you know, our men are... at best aware that women have magic. It's they are told to heed the warnings of women. Women weave fate. They are actors in a play. They just need to reach their fate. That's their job. He goes to the island. He gets to the farm. He's made a slave, or as part of this process, he becomes a slave. And we really don't get... Well, we finally catch back up with his uncle, who is really the next...
I mean, a lot of this is stage setting to see what is his uncle doing now? What is the situation there? Amleth kind of like figuring out like who is this person? Who are his sons? Getting a sense of like their character. And like a lot of like set positioning for where we will ultimately end up.
Yeah. So when we talk about like the types of masculinity we get in this movie... His uncle is the next set. Similar to what we've talked about in some of the other stuff, we have a less... he's still stoic. He's still a man's man, but he's dealing with his son whenever we first see him on the island. His son from Nicole Kidman's character, Alex Skarsgård's mom. And he's with his son, and they're hammering a fence in. And his son says, "Isn't this slave's work? Why are we doing this?" And his father says, "You know, you never know when you're going to be a slave or a king, so be good at both." Right? That's what I took from it anyway. That's not the direct quote.
Yeah, it's a very interesting situation where I certainly would not call the presentation of masculinity that he has a healthy presentation, but he is not doing the same men are revenge and rage that Amleth's father did. That there's a slightly different thing happening there.
I believe we come to it later, but he possesses the ability to feel love is the primary emotion that Skarsgård's character does not have for most of the film. Is he eventually feels love for his children and love for his wife that one, the king from the beginning of the film did not. So whenever his son says, "Well, why are we doing this?" he has an awareness, at least. He may not be in touch with it, but he has an awareness of a man could be a king or a slave, so be good at both. And this is something he wants his son to know. He's spending time with his son where the king from earlier wanted his son know how to be a wolf. This man's teaching his kid how to potentially be a slave. So the expectations are different for each one of these characters, mostly because it's coming out of a lived experience and care, right? He knows that he's been forced to this island alone and he has to do more of this himself. His son will probably be in an even worse position. And he's doing what he thinks is best. And that is a different layer on the same cake, let's say.
You get the masculinity as like the provider figure. So it's not just the protector. It is also the provider. And that provider can be love. It is still a harder love than, certainly a harder love than what we saw in The Green Knight. So it's still a harder love, but it is definitely something that is less, you know, you used the phrase toxic earlier, it is less toxic, still toxic, less toxic than what the king showed to Amleth.
Right. With that, too, we see this reflected later on and from more people as well.
Yes.
Specifically about the uncle character. He is referred to later as... not even a better man than the king from earlier, a better man than his brother. The whole thing that we eventually get into with him is that he just has the ability to have emotion. And that's what separates him from his brother, which is why the queen picked him over the king. Is he's an easier man to deal with, right? Not because he's better, not because he's a greater man, a capital G greater man, but because he's easier.
There's some reciprocation there, and it regardless of whether it is an appropriate level of reciprocation, you're going from zero to something.
Yeah, he has softness to him. To use words to describe us, he's a softer man, but not by much. He's still rock hard, but he is a slightly softer man. As it comes to his children, his relationship with his wife, and the relationship with even his blood kin, right? Like, whenever he realizes that Skarsgård is in fact his nephew that he did try to kill, they eventually come to terms and in a way that's a little bit different than you would expect with what he did with his brother the first time through.
Yeah. You do get the sense that he is, he is a man who could be reasoned with, whereas the king, vengeance is it. Also, bad news. Sometimes, if you don't go to therapy for the lessons that your dad has taught you, you become your father.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You become the exact man that your father was. Absolutely, yes. So, as the film goes on, unlike in The Green Knight, where our character is tested and consistently shown other ways to be, Skarsgård really isn't in the film. His character really doesn't get an opportunity to change and adapt. The witch, Olga, eventually convinces him that this is a good idea, that she's going to help him kill his uncle, and does things like poisons everyone with mushrooms and kind of helps him on his journey, which is really funny because she's the competent one.
Yes.
And he's like, I don't know, I'm going to kill everyone and do whatever. And she's like, oh, if you're going to do that, you should do it like this.
Well, and like that is very much a scenario where you have there is a way in which in both The Green Knight and this movie that, you know, femininity is feeding into masculinity and sort of like setting the stage for like what it is able to do and sometimes providing support for masculinity. And that is very much a thing that she does in this movie.
Yeah. Same thing with the queen character, also very much a support character for both of her husbands.
Yes.
Right? And even not really, doesn't really provide emotional support for her oldest son, but her youngest son somewhat. And doesn't seem like a terrible stepmom to her.
No,
son either.
Fascinating scenario where, we get a lot of information about her. We get a little bit of information about her just from witnessing the way that she is when we finally do get to the farm. But we get a lot of information from her when finally Amleth and her interact again for the first time in years and years and years. Where suddenly that's when you find out, no, I wasn't taken by your uncle. He didn't steal me. No, your father was emotionally broken, and I wanted somebody who had an emotion. So she shares that with Amleth, and you can tell that like very much he is confronted with the realization that the situation was more complicated than he thought it was, and that his mother actually has needs and emotions, and that his father was not capable of meeting the needs that she had. You get the sense that, like, in some ways she was in the right and in some ways she was in the wrong. Like, she becomes a very, very nuanced character in a way that we don't get to see fully until that moment. And that ends up interacting with Amleth's masculinity, because what does it mean to have a mother that you have put on a pedestal, that you have treated as though they were like a goddess, untouchable, pure, that you fail to recognize that your mother is a human being, and you have to come to terms with that, and that your masculinity is partially informed by your idea that it is my job to save this sacred woman because she is incapable of doing it for herself, and she's at the whims of all these men that are around her. And then you also have to deal with the recognition that what does it mean that his father has dimensions that he did not recognize? And what are those dimensions that he is perpetuating? And what does that say? He very clearly is having a bad time after he has that conversation with her.
Yeah. His mom kisses him on the mouth.
Yeah.
Which, like, I don't know any healthy... As far as a act of being manly, like let's use being kissed by Nicole Kidman, you know, let's use that as a thing that would generally be seen as a good manly thing, right? What if Nicole Kidman's your mom and she kisses you on the mouth in a weird way? Less healthy. It's a less healthy reaction that he also has to it as well, because he kind of leans in before he leans. The whole thing. Whew, boy.
Well, because of the version of masculinity that he has been in some ways forced to and in some ways has then just embraced, he is not getting his emotional needs met either. And part of that, he starts to lean into his mother and the like physical closeness that that would provide. You're like, oh, buddy, that's not a healthy way to deal with that.
No, the whole thing is icky. The acting in that scene is so good.
It is. They are both. Nicole Kidman is impeccable in it.
Yep. Skarsgård, great. They both know. Again, they played husband and wife in another thing. So like they know how to make that thing weird and have tension and be strange for a thing that should kind of come off as stupid whenever you say it out loud. I don't have a lot of other aspects. I mean, as far as like our dimensions of masculinity go, eventually we're introduced to the princes and their friends and they all get
murdered. You don't get really any other depictions, any other interpretations. What you really do get is just variations on the theme or explorations of the theme. And a lot of that is Amleth just being brutal and as much of that version of masculinity as you can imagine.
There are some plays on it with eventually his destiny. Like his destiny is to be the father of the Maiden King. So, you know, there's something to be said there for kind of the direction that his life or his world goes later. You know, like there's something to that.
So now we are starting to get into, I mentioned this to Justice before we started recording. This is a movie that I had a very difficult time with the first time that I watched it and then watched it again. And I knew before I started, I'm like, oh, God, I'm going to have to watch this movie again. And like, not because it's beautifully shot. There's a lot of things that the movie does very well. And like this is a scenario where this is a movie that I don't like, but I don't think it is because it's a bad movie. I think it is because it is not a movie for me. Not a movie for me.
You know, I will say this, that I did watch it. This is the second time that I've seen it as well. I don't know if I think that it is enjoyable, but I think it's something that I have a hard time looking away from. And the first time I saw it, I was really interested in what it was doing. The second time through it, it wasn't that I wasn't interested in what it was doing. It's a gorgeous film.
Yes.
And I could also understand watching it twice and never coming back to it. Like or once and kind of, it's fine. It's on Amazon Prime streaming, right? Like if you want to watch, if you want to seek this thing out, go watch it. It eventually ends with two men fighting naked and a volcano, and like that's cool, but our characters don't ever evolve, especially coming off of this. I watched this movie last, so especially off
as
of
did I, yeah.
where other characters for this specific thought have grown and adapted and learned. Just guys being dudes top to bottom, just and it's cool. I'm good.
Yeah, so for me, part of what ends up making it difficult for me to watch is that I think Eggers has an idea that he is attempting to, a conversation that he wants to have about masculinity, and I think part of that conversation does involve the ways in which I think he is curious about how a very brutal and very animalistic version of masculinity can be problematic. And I think there are a bunch of ways in the film he gestures at, isn't it bad that Amleth wants revenge? Aren't we upset that he can't seem to not do revenge? But then he makes that look super cool. Or I don't even want to say he makes it look super cool. He presents it in a way that, like, I feel like this falls into a bit of like the Fight Club problem, where if you don't come into this movie with a nuanced idea of what masculinity is, if you see that fight in the volcano, you're going to be like, this is the freaking best. I love these two dudes. That's not a good fight. That's a bad thing to happen. That's not the good outcome. But it's very easy if you don't have a lens through which to like think through the ideas about masculinity that Eggers is attempting to wrestle with, that like you'll miss entirely. And I think that's a way that Eggers fails to make that mark. And I think he's interested in it, but I honestly don't know if he is, if he wants to do the thing that I would have preferred, which is to make a more clear statement about, hey, revenge will prevent you from being able to feel the full gamut of emotions. Like, he presents Amleth with love through Olga and goes, kindness is another option. He's even told, you're going to have to choose. Are you going to do the revenge or are you going to do kindness? And the kindness is, go love your family. Go love the unborn twins that you have by this woman who you clearly care for. Or go have a really cool battle on a volcano with a sword that sucks in the night.
Right.
And yeah. he picks the sword.
Well, he tries to say, I want to do both.
He does.
Specifically,
I got very, very excited there. Yeah.
Specifically, he comes back and he says, I would like to do both. And with that, what he says is, by both, I mean, I'm going to do the thing that I want to do, which is go die in a volcano.
Yeah.
You know, that's not both still. But he's like, oh, well, I'm protecting my family because by going into the volcano, I know my uncle will be dead and he will not come revenge my have his revenge like I did, because it's a self-perpetuating cycle. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Men do two things: sire children and have revenge, right? Like, that's it. And that's not the part that I walked away from wishing that it was better. Like, that's as a story, whatever, fine. Like, I'm not here to tell you how to make your story about toxic men have more toxic men.
Right.
But yeah, the fact that it is so beautifully shot, the fact that it is a compelling visual thing, and you don't have to rub your nose in it, but
yes,
he could have done a little bit more to be like, maybe these people are unhealthy. You have to you can walk away from that thing surface level and get the wrong message.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of what's tricky is, I think Eggers does want to have some latitude to indulge in the spectacle. And for me, I am not interested in, there's some of that spectacle, some of those beautiful shots, like some of the instances where he's dealing with witchcraft and with the mythology, it's gorgeous. But some of it is just brutal. Some of it is over the top gore. And that is also spectacle that I think he enjoys spending time in. And that feeds into the commentary on masculinity and what he's trying to say. I didn't have a good time with it, and I don't know that it always serves what he is attempting to do, and it muddles it, so I don't even know exactly what he is attempting to do with masculinity. So that makes it very hard for me to be able to view that spectacle and go, this is worthwhile to be here, because I don't even know why you have it.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I definitely think we move on from this thing.
Yes.
No one learns. We don't really learn. We kind of have a thought on it, and then it ends. That thought ends. There's a period. He rides off to Valhalla.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yep.
And with that, that's it. For the Northmen, anyway. Quick break. Oh, quick break, and we'll be right back with Creed. And we're actually not going to be right back. That's going to be the end of the episode for this week. We went too long. So what we did is we cut this thing in half. You will get the second half of the conversation with the other two movies here in about 2 weeks' time. So we'll get that out before the middle of February. So we'll see you soon. Take care. You can email us at us@fugazipod.com. Get a hold of us. Thanks a lot. Take care.